Welcome to A Katra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Katra AI.
Okay, so today we're diving deep into a real landmark of American literature. Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest from 1962. This book, I mean, it's just such a potent, almost disturbing allegory, isn't it? About the individual spirit fighting against institutional control.
Mm-hmm.
So for you listening, our mission here is to really unpack the core elements. We want to get into the characters, the heavy symbolism, and, well, why this story still hits so hard today.
Absolutely. And to really get the raw power of this novel, you kind of have to look at Kesey himself. He wasn't just a writer. He was, you could say, a cultural catalyst. His life fed directly into his work.
Yeah. How so?
Well, he grew up out west, you know, the American West, which gives you that streak of individualism. But the real, the foundational stuff, it actually came from, well, it's ironic. He volunteered for those government-sponsored LSD experiments at Stanford.
Right. That context is just...
Oh, wow.
So an official program using a drug meant to mess with reality ends up sparking a book that questions all authority.
Yeah.
It's almost too perfect.
It really is. And then you add in his time working as an attendant on a psychiatric ward at night.
Ah, okay. So he saw it firsthand.
Exactly. He saw the mechanics of control up close. And the LSD experiences, well, they gave him this philosophical angle, a way to ask whose reality is actually sane here. Plus, he was a founding member of the Merry Pranksters, living that whole counterculture thing. Absolute chaotic freedom. So the book isn't just fiction. It's almost like a manifesto against, you know, the system's grip on the human soul.
Okay, so he channels all that anti-establishment fire into this setting, a sterile, inescapable Oregon psychiatric ward. The hospital itself becomes a kind of microcosm, right? A place to dissect society's oppressive machinery. So let's get right into it. What's the core conflict here? What made this book just explode onto the scene in the 60s?
Well, at its heart, the conflict is life versus stagnation. Simple as that, almost. The ward is basically engineered for docile submission. And the architect of that submission, Nurse Ratched, the big nurse.
The infamous Nurse Ratched.
Infamous, yes. And her power, we need to be clear, it's not about like physical beatings or anything obvious. It's way more insidious. It's all psychological manipulation. She uses shame, guilt, the patient's deepest fears against them. She's like the embodiment of cold bureaucratic power. Always calm, always smiling, that tight little smile. Dehumanizing.
Can you give an example?
Yeah.
How does she exert that control day to day? It's not direct orders, is it? It's more about manipulating the group.
Exactly. The group meetings are her stage. She never raises her voice, but she orchestrates them like demolition jobs. She'll subtly bring up someone's insecurity, maybe a past mistake. Then she just sits back and watches the other patients who are terrified they'll be next to just tear that person down. She turns their own self-loathing into a weapon, makes them police each other. It's chilling.
And we see all this suffocating control, through the eyes of someone who's completely withdrawn, Chief Bromden, this huge half-Native American guy who pretends he can't hear or speak.
Yeah.
Why him? Why is his perspective so key to the whole allegory?
Bromden's viewpoint is everything because he doesn't see a hospital. He sees this vast mechanical system designed to crush life. He talks about the fog. That's his word for the psychological dissociation, right? The way the institution uses confusion, medication to keep everyone compliant. Numb.
The fog.
Yeah. And he calls the overall controlling force the Combine. It's his name for this huge, invisible, dehumanizing machine that runs everything way beyond just the ward walls.
The Combine. That sounds almost like something out of science fiction. Like the ward is just one small part of a bigger, oppressive system. And then into this tightly controlled world of fear and fog, boom, Randall Patrick McMurphy arrives.
He's the ultimate disruption, just a force of nature. McMurphy's this loud, swaggering, gambling Irishman, sees rules as dares. He first gets himself committed because he's faking psychosis, right?
Yeah.
To get out of hard labor on a prison farm. He's just this whirlwind of raw, untamed energy.
And it's interesting, like you said, he starts out just looking out for himself. But when does that change? When does he go from con man to, well, a kind of hero for the other patients?
I think it shifts when he really sees what's going on. He expected, you know, prison bars, guards maybe. Instead, he finds this quiet, smiling tyranny. And he realizes these men aren't just inmates, they're victims. They've been convinced they're powerless. So suddenly, it's not about getting an easy ride anymore. It becomes about proving that their spirit isn't actually broken. McMurphy, maybe without even meaning to at first, becomes the symbol of that unconquerable human spirit, the total opposite of Ratched's cold control.
And Kesey brilliantly tracks this escalation through these, like, symbolic battles. It really is McMurphy's chaotic, life-loving individualism against Ratchet's cold systemic control. Let's talk about that first big clash, the one over the TV schedule.
Yeah, it seems small, but it's so important. McMurphy wants to change the TV time so the men can watch the World Series. Ratch shuts him down, uses some bureaucratic rule about votes she totally controls. So when she refuses, McMurphy stages this silent protest. He just sits down right in front of the blank TV screen.
I love that image. Just sitting there, staring at nothing, pretending the game's on, calling out plays. What does that actually achieve?
It forces a choice on the other men. Do they believe the reality of the blank screen? Or do they buy into McMurphy's reality? A reality where they still have the right to want something, to imagine, to, you know, see the game. It's pure psychological warfare. And when other patients slowly join him, just sitting there watching the blank game, well, that's the first real crack you see in Ratched's solid wall of authority.
And that act of defiance, it's like it pulls Chief Bromden out of his shell, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's where his own journey really starts picking up speed, from just watching catatonic to actually participating.
Absolutely. McMurphy is the first person in ages who actually sees Bromden, challenges the whole deaf and dumb act, recognizes the person hiding in the fog. He even tosses him a baseball once. Just a simple human gesture, that connection between them becomes the real emotional heart of the story.
Okay, then comes the midpoint, which feels like the most, maybe, joyful part of the book. The deep sea fishing trip. Unauthorized, of course.
Yeah.
McMurphy basically busts a group of patients out for a day on the ocean.
Yeah, it's an escape, both literally and metaphorically. Out on that boat, away from her eyes, the men rediscover something. Joy, adventure, just being men together, camaraderie. See, the ward is designed to emasculate them, right? To use shame, to strip away their competence, their agency. But out there, catching fish, dealing with the waves, they're capable again. They're working together. They're men. It's a powerful act of remasculinization.
And when they come back, all sunburned and proud, carrying these huge fish, it's a major blow to Ratchet's control. But then the mood shifts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Big Murphy finds out he's actually committed. He can't just leave when he wants. Only Ratchet can sign off on his release.
That discovery just adds this heavy, tragic weight to everything he does from then on. Suddenly, pushing back isn't just about winning arguments. It's risking, well, maybe permanent institutionalization or worse. And yet, he stays. He keeps fighting for the others.
It becomes truly heroic at that point. And it really underscores his whole philosophy, right? That quote about laughter.
Oh, yeah. Man, when you lose your laugh, you lose your footing. For McMurphy, humor isn't just fun. It's essential resistance. It's how you keep your balance against the terror.
Which leads us to the final explosive act of liberation.
Yeah.
The ward party. McMurphy knows the walls are closing in, so he orchestrates this huge chaotic night.
Smuggles in women, booze, just a night of pure, authentic, messy human connection.
And the focus shifts heavily to Billy Bibbit, the really shy young man with the terrible stutter. And during that party, Billy had this breakthrough moment. He sleeps with one of the women, loses his virginity, and for a moment, his stutter, his fear, they just vanish.
It's a beautiful, fragile triumph. Mm. But Ratched finds out the next morning, and she destroys him. Not by yelling. Oh, no. She just looks at him very calmly and threatens to tell his mother what he did. That single, calculated piece of cruelty, hitting his deepest shame, it breaks him. Billy, who still needs her approval in some twisted way, he commits suicide.
Billy's death. That's the point of no return. McMurphy's fight goes from defiance to just pure righteous rage.
It absolutely is. It triggers McMurphy's own final fatal act of rebellion. He physically attacks Rash. It's shocking. He rips her uniform open and crucially exposes her breast. He shatters that image she has cultivated, the invincible, sexless automaton of the Combine. He reveals her as just a person, taking away her ultimate power, that facade.
But the price for that outburst is absolute. He's dragged off, and when he comes back, he's been lobotomized. It seems like the institution's final crushing victory, the ultimate silencing of the individual spirit.
It looks like total defeat on the surface, but in the logic of the allegory, it's actually a different kind of win. McMurphy becomes a martyr figure, almost Christ-like. His sacrifice is what saves the others. His spirit, even though his mind is gone, it awakens everyone else. He bought their freedom, in a way.
Which brings us to the ending, focused entirely on Chief Bromden. Ratched plans to leave the lobotomized McMurphy on the ward as a warning, right? Like, see, this is what happens when you resist.
Exactly. A symbol of futility. But Bromden sees it differently. He's inspired by McMurphy's courage, but he also realizes the spirit, The real McMurphy is gone. So he performs this act of mercy. He smothers McMurphy, releasing his spirit from the ruined shell of his body. And that act of freeing McMurphy leads directly to Bromden freeing himself.
We have to talk about the control panel, that heavy hydrotherapy console. Earlier, McMurphy tried with all his might to lift it, to prove it could be done, and failed, symbolizing maybe the crushing weight of the institution. Why is it so crucial that Bromden can lift it at the end?
It's the perfect symbolic bookend, the ultimate thematic triumph. McMurphy failed maybe because he relied just on physical strength, on ego. Bromden succeeds because he's now fueled by McMurphy's spirit, by his own rediscovered will. He's not just muscle, he's spirit embodied. He lifts that massive thing, smashes the window, a literal break from the system, and escapes into the night. It proves that the spiritual victory, the force of will, can ultimately overcome the system's physical power. The Combine can break a body, but it can't kill the spirit once it's truly awake.
And his escape mirrors his narration, too. As he runs, the writing becomes clear, lucid. The fog is finally gone. His mind is free along with his body.
Which throws us right back to Kesey's central, nagging question about sanity and madness. If the institution uses shock therapy, drugs, lobotomies to fix people, maybe the institution itself, this oppressive system, is the truly insane entity.
Right. Kesey definitely suggests that the ones labeled insane might actually be the ones seeing things most clearly. And he uses those literary tools so effectively. Bromden's initially unreliable narration, the hallucinations that are really metaphors for oppression. The whole hospital is this terrifying allegory.
And it brings us back to that idea about truth in the novel, summed up in that line often attributed to Bromden. But it's the truth even if it didn't happen. It means the emotional truth about dignity, oppression, connection that matters more than just the literal facts. Kesey is shouting that real human connection, individual dignity, they are worth fighting for no matter the cost.
So One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest shows you, pretty brutally, that resisting oppression is dangerous. It has huge risks. But the alternative, conformity, silence, is presented as a kind of spiritual death. It's just this relentless, powerful celebration of the defiant human spirit refusing to be broken.
And maybe the lasting lesson here, the thing to really think about, is how the novel warns us that the most dangerous kinds of control often wear a mask. They might look like help or care or what's best for everyone. It really hammers home the need for critical thinking, for always asking, you know, who benefits from this order in every part of life, not just in institutions.
A sobering but ultimately vital message.
Definitely.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.